So, another month together. I went to Victoria over the weekend, actually on Sunday. And because I was going to give this talk at Victoria Insight Meditation Society. There's one of their board members, somebody I went through the CDL, the Community Dharma Leader Program with. So we were sitting on the clipper and the boat started rocking. So I thought, I'm going to get seasick and then I won't be able to talk. So I am going to take whatever that stuff is that they give you, preventative measures so that I won't have seasickness. And it's true. I did not have any seasickness, but I have been sleepy for 3 days. I don't know what is in that stuff. Maybe that's why you don't get seasick, because you just go to sleep. I've been sleepy for 3 days. It's unbelievable. And what makes it so bad is, this is so embarrassing. The place I was sitting, since it was just me, a group of family came and sat down with us. And so the woman that was sitting across from me, she looks at it and she goes, oh, I don't want to take that. It's way too many chemicals. I don't know what that is. And ever since then, I've been thinking, oh my God, I put all these chemicals in my body. I don't know what it is and it makes me sleepy. Anyway, it's the nature of the talk tonight, I guess. So I thought I would talk a little bit about sort of this idea. Well, let me just back up a moment. Mindfulness, you know, is getting pretty common, pretty commonplace. So it's almost like it's a fad. I don't want to say a fad, but it feels sort of like a fad. And people who don't even practice come up to me and tell me about mindfulness, and I really want to laugh, but they're dead serious about what it is they think mindfulness is. And so I don't want to create this idea that I'm saying, oh, well, secular mindfulness is not really any good, because it's not true. I mean, we all know there are all these studies that have done that show that mindfulness helps with productivity, and it does all this help in general and helping people, you know, just increase their trauma threshold. It's not like mindfulness does not have any benefits and it doesn't do something that makes us have better lives, makes us better people. But that is not the direction of this talk. This month, that is not, I believe that is not why we come together, is not to be better people. I mean, there's a bit of hoping that we're better people, but there's something else behind that that I'd like to talk about this month, something else that draws us near to this practice of Dhamma, which is directed towards the liberation of the mind instead. And then to make matters worse, we don't actually practice. I mean, in some respects, we can kind of think of practice as something you have to be monastic and you have to kind of go out in the forest and live as a hermit for months on end, years on end, aiming for this idea of enlightenment, and it's hard work, and you can't have anything, and you can't want anything, and it just makes for a very miserable idea of what it is that the sort of, I guess, the pinnacle of what this practice is all about, and why would anyone want to do that? But it seems here in this urban setting, we are householders. That's what we are. We're not these monastic people. We're not the people that are living in the forest. So we're householders. And there's a question, can a householder really truly think about this idea of enlightenment and liberation of the mind? If you're a householder, can you really truly practice in such a way that any kind of liberation of the mind is even possible? That's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about how it is, what it is that as householders we can kind of turn our attention towards. There's a sutta, and I hope I can find it for next week's talk when we have a discussion night. Because there's a sutta where somebody, I'm not going to do it justice, but I'm going to say it anyway. Somebody came to the Buddha and said, you know, it's all well and good what you do for monastics, but we're householders. So we like laying in the bed, having a lot of children, and eating a lot. You know, sort of like pointing to this kind of lazy, plain kind of existence with a lot of pleasure. How is it that we're going to end up? I mean, is this idea of enlightenment just not available or not possible for us? And the Buddha, who's monastic and has all these monastic people with him, he didn't respond out of this kind of, well, okay, you can have a minimal life, but you can have relaxation. You can be a happier or better person. He pointed this householder towards liberation of the mind, the same liberation his monks were doing, except he was pointing in a different direction. So we are going to get liberated, not outside of our ordinary life, inside our ordinary life. Whatever it is that that life looks like, that's where we're going to get our liberation from. In fact, Jack Kornfield, he said the real world is beyond our thoughts and ideas. We see through the net of our desires, divided into pleasure and pain, right and wrong, inner and outer. To see the universe as it is, you must step beyond the net. It's not hard to do, for the net is full of holes. It's sort of like, could we see the holes within our current ordinary life so that the life that we're living is not quite so opaque that we can't see the liberation in it? The Dhamma is divided into two wings, they say, compassion and wisdom. You need them both to sort of fly and see above, see the truth of things. So I thought we could look at that, instead of from compassion and wisdom, we could look at that same concept through the continuity of suffering and the continuity of mindfulness. So tonight, this week and next week, we'll talk about the continuity of suffering, and then the last 2 weeks, we'll talk about the continuity of mindfulness. So we're going to start out this path. And Buddha said, in our very search for perfection outside of ourselves is what causes our suffering. So if we're going to start on a path, a search into this liberation in our ordinary life, we have to sort of start out on a noble search, but the search is going to have to go inside within us. It's going to have to somehow or another encapsulate the life that we actually live. there is a Buddhist principle called beginning to see the preciousness of this human birth. And in some respects, we don't, I think they talk about it a lot in Tibetan Mahayana type practices, in Tibetan and Zen, but they don't really talk about it as much in Theravadan practice. But the concept of preciousness of this life, this human birth, it doesn't mean that somehow or another you have to have a good life. You have to have some kind of a special life. You have to have some gifts or something has to happen that brings about a great life. And I think probably in our Western thought, or not Western thought, but our regular, what we considered our civilized thinking, that's what we would look for. We would look for what's the good stuff. When we talk to each other, we're like, well, what are you doing? I told some people that, you know, I would go around my lawyer friends and they would say, oh, Tori, what are you doing? And I say, oh, I teach meditation. And they're like, yeah, well, I mean, but what are you doing? Like, what your work? And I said, that's it. That's what I do, I teach meditation. And they have this kind of look on their face like, that's it? That's it? What happened to the law? What happened to years of college? And almost in kind of a patting me on the head, they're like, well, you know, if I hear of anything, you know, I'll let you know. So it's not that. It's not that you're looking at the preciousness of a human birth. It's beginning to see that whatever is showing up in your ordinary everyday life is your precious human birth. It is, that is your capacity for awakening. Not something else. Not when something else gets better. I have a little saying at my house that says, same old slippers, same old rice, same old glance at paradise. So I look at that all the time. I'm always looking at it saying, okay, this is what it is. Whatever it is showing up, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where liberation happens. So we're going to start out on this noble search, a noble search into the liberation of mind. And it's not starting out from a place of there's something wrong, so I'm going to try to go and get something right. It's starting out, a noble search is not a search for something better. It's not a search for something greater. This noble search is for a search of something expansive, something that makes us alive. It's more clear. It's like taking a lens that's out of focus and tuning it up so that it's very much in focus. It's sort of the difference between the cameras that used to be attached to cell phones and the cameras that are on cell phones now. If you've ever seen a camera through an old cell phone, you'd be shocked. It's like it's nothing like what we can see now. We can see little tiny ants in our cell phones now. But when the camera first came out in cell phones, you'd be lucky if you could get the picture of the car. So what we're doing is we're trying to go into this expansiveness in this search for some liberated place. And that liberated place, it's referred to as the deathless. It's referred to as enlightenment. I'm not enlightened, so I don't know what it is. I can't tell you what it is, but I know the longing for it. I know the internal search for it. So that's what we're going to talk about from suffering. So Buddha said there were three different types of suffering. He said there was a suffering for physical pain, the mental anguish we have, suffering associated with the mere existing in a conditioned world, and the suffering that's associated with change. Now think about that. All things are impermanent. So there is always going to be change. Can't leave that. Everything is conditioned that we live in. Everything is based on some building of conditions and previous conditions in our world. Everything we have, our job, our cars, our house, clothes, everything is based on this conditioning. And the mere fact that we are in a human body, everybody in this room is going to go through some kind of physical pain and the mental anguish associated with it. Even if you are in perfect health until the day you die, you will be experiencing some pain, some physical anguish about being in this very fragile body. So if the nature of suffering is associated with existing with conditioning, existing in a world that changes, and existing with physical pain, then why do we constantly try to live our lives without it, without the suffering? Why is there this need to move away from suffering towards pleasure? That's the noble search. Why do we do that? Why are we constantly seeking this pleasure when we know inherently it's not even possible? So I thought I would take us into a couple of things, like maybe three steps to take towards a different way of looking at this idea of suffering and the conditions associated with that suffering. I thought if we looked at it, if we approached it maybe from a different way, we could begin to see that it's not the suffering that's causing us the problem. It's the seeking that's causing the problem. It's what it is that we're seeking. So the first thing I thought we'd say, think of is the first step, is to come to this understanding that Dhamma, this practice of Dhamma, is not a healing practice. So even though I came into this practice with a whole bunch of wounds and was looking for a lot of healing, and maybe a lot of you were the same way, Dhamma is not going to heal. It never has healed. It doesn't heal. We see more clearly and we see differently, but it doesn't heal. The reason why it doesn't heal is because inherent in our natural thinking of healing, you have to have a problem to heal from. You have to have something that has stirred you wrong and you want to heal from it. But in the Dhamma, there is no problem. Everything as it exists, exists outside of a problem. So we are trying to look into something that inherently we think there's a problem to heal from it, and there's no problem there. Now that might stir us up a bit, because even as I sit here, I could run off a list of things that I think are problematic. I can feel it. You know that we think there's a problem. So even when I say that, I know you're sitting there thinking, I know, this is a problem. This is a problem. The problem that we begin to create in our view that there is a problem, kind of apply Dhamma to the problem, is that in order for that problem to exist, it's not possible for it to not exist. This is the kind of circular distortion that the mind does with us, because the minute you have a problem, what you're basically saying is, if I get my way, then there's no problem. But that is not even possible in a world where there's always change and everything is based on conditioning, and we live in a fragile human body subject to pain and anguish. So inherent in our search for something to heal us and sort of fix the problem, we are already going in the wrong direction. Another way to think about it is a little different. Pema Chodron says that until we stop clinging to the concept of good and evil, the world will continue to manifest as friendly goddesses and harmful demons. So I have to think about that. Until we can get to a place where we stop thinking whatever is in reality is a problem, and we begin to think that it is just reality, something that we have to deal with, but still reality, then we will forever be trapped in this idea that there is a good and a bad, a right and a wrong, a painful and an unpainful, a pleasant or an unpleasant. The view that liberation is pointing to is to stop thinking of something as being a problem, period. To begin to see that whatever is arising, whatever has come to be, is the reality. We need to respond to it, but it is the reality. Not that it is a problem, but that it is the reality. So, one way we can begin to think about how do we begin to see that we're actually seeing a problem is to begin to think about what it is that we're trying to do to get away from some difficulty. We just pay attention to how we try to escape whatever difficulty is there. I guess sometimes when I think about Dhamma and I think about the way we talk about it, it can sound a little as if it's contradictory, because on one hand we're talking about suffering and that it is a constant thing and it's always here, and then in the second hand we're saying somehow or another we're going to reach a point when we're enlightened and there is no suffering. So you can see why the mind would think that suffering is the problem and we're going to a time, a place, where there is no suffering. But what if there's another way to think about this no suffering? What if there's another way to think of suffering or the non-existence of suffering as not associated with whether or not something is pleasant or unpleasant, whether or not something is comfortable or uncomfortable, that the cessation of suffering isn't connected to whether something is painful or unpainful or pleasant, comfortable or uncomfortable. To get there, you'd have to do something, what I would consider step two. So the first step, no problem. Second step is you'd have to let go of this idea that we're supposed to be happy. That somehow or another, we have this idea that this happiness is going to come not necessarily from, we can kind of know that, okay, I know my stuff isn't going to make me happy. I've been practicing long enough that I know that, you know, just because I have a good job or just because I have a job, a house, these kinds of material things aren't necessarily going to make me happy. I know that. But back in the recesses of our minds, we still think, I'm still supposed to be happy. Just let yourself wake up one morning and you're in a grumpy mood. You're just like, what am I? Even your partner is like, what's wrong with you? You're in a grumpy mood. You should get happy. We should be happy. Right? I mean, just imagine if you came up against somebody and you're talking to them and they're just like, something's wrong. Even though we say all the time that we know that these things, these conditioned things, are not going to make us happy, we still assume we are supposed to be happy. And if we're not happy, something's wrong. It cannot be that life is supposed to be non-happy. So I have to use my Milarepa quote because I love him and I quote him as often as I can. He is a man after my own heart. And I love this quote mainly because I think of it like a koan from Zen. You know, like trying my best to work with it, to see it as truthful. But he says, see demons as demons, that is the danger. So if you see this idea that there's some demon out there, you know there's a demon out there. You've seen them. I know them. I've seen them. I can spout a few here, but I won't. If you see demons as demons, that is the danger. If you know that they are powerless, that is the way. So we're getting in a little search here. If you understand them for what they are, that is deliverance. So you're beginning to chip away at this idea. It's not that we don't see demons as demons, but we're beginning to see the danger in what it means to put up these right wrongs, good, bad, evil goddesses. So if you see demons as demons, that is the danger. You know they are powerless, that is the way. You understand them for what they are, that is deliverance. If you recognize them as your father and mother, that is their end. And if you realize that they are creations of the mind, they become its glory. When these truths are known, all is liberation. All is liberation. That means whatever it is that we think of as difficult, suffering, problematic, it's liberation. It's all liberation. It's why we have to let go of this idea that we have to be happy. It's why we have to chip away and begin to try to see if we are really secretly seeking this happiness. Because if we are even secretly seeking the happiness and we do not look for that and chip away at it and begin to investigate whether it is that, then all of our efforts for towards a liberated mind fall on deaf ears, because we are trapped in this forever expectation of happiness. Now think about it. How many of you are thinking to yourself, but if I'm not happy, what would be the point? What is it that could be there if I'm not happy? Suffering. We're pointing to this idea of suffering. And we're trying to see what is it about suffering that brings us into some other space. So I just want to share one more step. You have to let go of the idea that there's a problem. You have to let go of the idea that we are supposed to be happy. And you have to let go of the idea that we somehow need to know something. We need to know how to do this. It's not something that you can understand from a thinking and knowledge. It's not something that, you know, when we sit here in the Dhamma talks and we come on Tuesday night, it's not like you're going to hear this Dhamma talk and that's it. I got it. I'm going on. I can take it all. I can do whatever now. I got it. That's it. It's not like that. The Dhamma talks that you hear here, that you hear when we come here, is to inspire you so that when you go out that door and you live your ordinary life, you can see the preciousness of that life you're living. You can see in anything that shows up that there is a path to liberation in any moment. And all these moments keep coming at you, keep coming at you, keep coming at you for this path of liberation. So there's this constant capacity to choose into that over and over and over. Dhamma is something that we experience, this idea of liberation. Jack Kornfield said that we must look at our life without sentimentality, exaggeration, or idealism. Does what we are choosing reflect what we deeply value? It's really looking at that. In any moment, can you notice if you're stepping into a space that you value, or you're stepping into a space that, you know, you're just doing it because you think this is what you should do or what you ought to do? If you put your trust in this idea of that we're going to gain something, or we're going to accumulate something, or we're going to know something, it just spins in this circle and you get more material knowledge. I guess when I started practicing, sometimes it's a little shocking to me, and I have some friends that I kind of work with to help them learn a little Dhamma. They're too scared to come into a center. I keep telling them you should come to a Sangha, but you know, some people are scaredy cats. I would know. So I talk to them about this practice, and the one thing that always seems to show up is, my God, Tori, you've been doing it for 25 years and you're not enlightened? What is the point? I do think that sometimes, right? What is the point of all this? But then when I think about the difference in the way I practice now and the way I practiced for a good 20 years is vastly different. For most of the beginning years, I spent trying to learn something. I thought there was something out there I had to know. I can remember one day, I used to feverishly take notes. Every time Rodney gave a Dhamma talk, I was like, had my little notepad. I even had them color coordinated by sequence and all the little talks he gave. But I remember one time he said, I don't know why you guys, and I wasn't the only one, thankfully. Other people were taking notes. He said, I don't know why you guys are taking notes. It's not like anything I'm going to say. You're going to learn when you look back at those notes. I thought, he doesn't know, I got the notes. I know exactly what's going on. But have you ever read your notes from a Dhamma talk that you get? You write all the notes down and then you read back and you're like, what's so profound about that? I thought it was going to be some profound thing. And then when you read back over it, it's just this little, doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't even feel profound anymore. It did when you wrote it down. But then when you look at the actual notes, it doesn't have that profound sense in it. Because that the Dhamma is not what you read later. It's what you felt in the moment you heard it. And that's it. We're just trying to stay with these feelings and this connection that happens, and then when we go out that door, we can remember how I felt right then and there. We can remember that sense of freedom and that sense of courage that came from then. It's not in anything we learn. It's going to come from what we experience. So it's going to come from in some ordinary moment. When you are there, you, yourself, in that moment, take a chance on what it is that you hear in these Dhamma talks. You take a chance on applying it in that moment. Because if you're waiting for learning it, I'm here to tell you, 20 years, you can learn and learn and learn, and it just doesn't necessarily change your life. But when I started actually experiencing the Dhamma, I got out of my head and started experiencing the Dhamma. I guess it was longer than 5 years, so maybe 15 years of wandering in the desert. But in 2006, everything changed. Everything. And the doors just flung open. It's a completely different world when you experience the Dhamma as real and as right here and now, then when we think about it and contemplate what it could mean to be this person. I think I put my note down here. Oh, here it is. This Zen master, I think his name is Tazen Mizumi Roshi. He said, just live that life. It doesn't matter if it is life or hell. Life of the hungry ghost, life of the animal, it's okay. Just live that life. See. And as a matter of fact, no other way. Just stand where you stand, where you are. That's where your life is, right here, no matter how painful it is or how joyous it is. That's what it is. This is your life. That's it. It's just being right there. It's being right there, but it is applying this Dhamma to that moment. That's it. There's no trick to it. There's no intellectual knowing. It's in the applying the Dhamma right there in any given moment. So I want to tell us, I have four Dhamma principles I want to share about we can apply in any given moment. this sort of inward journey. Because even though we do this inward journey by ourselves, we're not going into this inner space alone. It does seem like, you know, I think sometimes when I first started practicing, it seemed like it was too isolating to try to do this by myself. Now, we do have to come to the Sangha in order to get the level of courage and confidence that we could go out there and do apply it. But when you're actually applying it, you're not by yourself. There is a 2,500-year lineage behind you of people faced with the exact same moment that you're faced with, applying the exact same principles at the same time. They have the same weariness, the same trepidation, the same kind of, okay, I'm gonna try it, but I don't know. They have that same energy. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have tried this, have been faced with that very same moment. So I want to try to point you to four. I mean, you know, there's tons of lists in Dhamma, but I'm going to point to four that I think work well in suffering. The first one is the three characteristics. We hear about them all the time: impermanence, dissatisfaction, and non-identification. We hear about it all the time. But what the three characteristics do is they are like a torch. They shine a bright light on any given moment. In any moment that you feel any sense of suffering, in that moment, you can find the three characteristics. You wouldn't be suffering but for the three characteristics, because the very nature of them is what creates our suffering. We are forever dissatisfied with the ever-changing nature of life. This constant and permanent nature of life, its ever-changing way. All things are conditioned upon it, and it's never really very personal. Mess just happens to us, happens to the world. So in any moment, you can shine this light of Dhamma on it, and you can look and see, am I trying to hold on to something that I need to let go of? It's time to move. Am I just dissatisfied with what's happening, the changing nature of things, or can I even look and see whether I'm taking something personal that really isn't personal? It's not that you have to like the situation, but you want to see where the nature of your suffering is showing up. So I thought I would share these four points with the wisdom guy of all suffering, which is Joseph Goldstein. He has these great quotes around it. So the first quote he says is, just as the light of a single candle can dispel the darkness of a thousand years, the moment we light a single candle of wisdom, no matter how long or how deep our confusion, ignorance is dispelled. So something as simple as looking into the three characteristics in any ordinary moment of difficulty, of tension, of rub, just looking into the three characteristics will shine a light of Dhamma. Second thing is the Four Noble Truths. This idea that there exists suffering, there's a cause for it, a cessation, and there's a way. So we can strengthen our practice with the Four Noble Truths. I think the Four Noble Truths are more like we apply them, we use them, we're there with them, and it begins to strengthen our practice, because we can begin to actually experience the cessation of suffering. Ajahn Sumedho gave an interview, and he explained this Four Noble Truths in an example so to the point, I carried that stupid book around with me all day so I would not forget to bring it. And of course, what do you think happened? Yes, I forgot to bring it. So that'll be for next week. But I can tell you, it's the perfect point. So you have to come next week so you can just see it. But anyway, the Four Noble Truths is what I think of as you're having this willingness. It strengthens our willingness to practice because we can begin to see the cessation of suffering. The Three Noble Truths, the three characteristics are more of the light that helps us shine a simple, small light into our ignorance to dispel it. So Joseph's way of looking at this is he said, the wonderful paradox about the truth of suffering is that the more we open to it and understand it, the lighter and freer our minds become. Our minds become more spacious and more open and happier as we move past our avoidance and denial to see what is true. We become less driven by compulsive desires and addictions because we can see clearly the nature of things as they are. So what you're actually doing with the Four Noble Truths is you're bringing up those difficulties, those emotional rubs, those difficult emotional parts of ourselves that we don't like, and beginning to investigate the nature of those emotional things, those emotional places. And you can see the cessation of them. The third sort of Dharma thing that I like to use, Dharma principle, is the eight pairs, the eight worldly concerns of pleasure, pain, gain, loss, praise, blame, fame, and irrepute, or fame and shame. Because I think of these as more like the guidepost for our ordinary living in any given moment. In any given moment that I feel any tension, any rub, any discomfort, or any situation, I try to figure out which of those eight worldly concerns is driving this moment, which one it is. I begin to look at it not from a place of trying to get rid of it, but more so I can normalize the whole nature of suffering. So this idea that suffering is not connected to somehow things are wrong, that I normalize this is the way things are in this moment. This is what has come to me in this moment. And just let it be however it is. The way a quote that Joseph, I think, points to this is he said, the tremendous danger is that this belief that genuine happiness comes only from pleasant feelings becomes a strong motivation to stay closed to anything unpleasant. But by staying closed to all unpleasantness, we also stay closed to our own wellspring of compassion. So whenever I feel myself in this kind of tension around the eight worldly concerns, it's not that I'm trying to get rid of the tension, because I, you know, on this end of the practice, I can sort of understand why Rodney would say sometimes, you know, like, I'm going in there. I can understand it, because there's a something about being with tension and being able to stay with it and not run from it, not close off or avoid it. So the eight worldly concerns help in that manner. It helps us constantly see that there are these eight tugs that are happening with us, and that it's so normal and so human that you can stop sort of worrying or fretting over whether or not those tugs are there. You just want to acknowledge them and, you know, call them out like, aha, I see you, Mara. I know what you're doing. I know where you're showing up here. So the last one, and this last one I think is probably the best practice the best Dhamma principle. It gets the least amount of respect, but it is the best practice, is renunciation. We don't really give renunciation like a really good respect, but renunciation, when you practice renunciation, meaning that you're actually stepping into letting go of these things that we are attached to. Yeah, you can open the whole door around continuity of suffering. Mostly, renunciation comes up in our practice when something is taken away from us and then we try to let it go. But another way to think of renunciation is, it is an intentional practice to let things go. Let things go before they're leaving. So you're looking into the difficulty by letting it go. You can see the difficulty by letting something go. You're stirring the pot. One last quote by Joseph. He said, imagine holding on to a hot burning coal. You would not fear letting it go. In fact, once you noticed that you were holding on, you would probably drop it quickly. But we often do not recognize how we hold on to suffering. It seems to hold on to us. This is the practice, becoming aware of how suffering arises in our mind and how we become identified with it, and learning to let it go. We learn through simple and direct observation, seeing the process over and over again until we understand. That is renunciation. But if we choose to renunciate, then we are stepping into the difficulty in a way that we can begin to get connected and close to and upfront with suffering and discomfort, not as life is throwing it at us, but because we are choosing this to try it out as practice. And it creates a capacity to have some detachment and to have a little bit of space as we start practicing around the difficulty. So I just want to end with this idea that even though we're going to talk about the continuity of mindfulness in the next couple of weeks, the continuity of mindfulness is no different than the continuity of suffering. Maybe if we could think of a different word for suffering, we'd have more connection to it. You know, we could call it cake, you know. That everybody would look forward to it, right? It was like, oh, that's cake. I have cake in my life, right? Right? So I thought of some words when I started practicing in this much more experiential way rather than the intellectual way I practice usually in the beginning. I used to call it opportunities. I used to call it possibility. I called it gifts. So when you think about it, words do mean something. And so maybe when we think about the continuity of suffering, we could think of it as the continuity of opportunity or the continuity of a gift. You know, this continuity of possibility towards liberation. If we did not have a continuous stream of possible moments to liberate, would it be worth it? We almost need, I mean, what if we only had one shot at it? I would have lost it a long time ago. I totally blew it. So there has to be this continuous continuity of opportunities for us to awaken. And that is a gift. So let's leave it there. We'll take a little bit of time for silence here. Okay, so if there's any questions, we'll take some questions. There's some time before announcements. Ah, yeah.
So, you know, I know you're a prosecutor and I'm a defense attorney, and this has been really great this last year when I got involved with this about me trying not to take the soulless devils of prosecutors.
That was an inside joke.
You know,
So I guess the question is, how do you take these principles, deal with difficult people? You can think of it that way.
Or in a trial.
Like, or even in a trial.
You were invested in an outcome and somebody was actively fighting against you. Mm-hmm. That's not something, I mean, that's part of your work.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
So the question is, how do I deal with this when I was working as a trial lawyer? How did I sort of deal with this idea that I'm vested in an outcome and it's very contentious. Trials can get very contentious. And I guess the best way to say it is, it's the continuity of suffering. It's this continuity of having this opportunity to deal with it. It's not that I didn't get triggered or I didn't get angry or didn't get mad. But there is a way to begin to live out of your internal center that instead of constantly looking outside of you as that is the reason why I'm angry, that is the reason why something's going wrong, that is the reason why I'm having difficulty, that you begin to look inside and there's this constant shifting because you can feel the tension inside. So I guess the best way to describe it is instead of this constant blaming outside, it just became this constant readjusting and realigning inside with the tension. So I begin to just feel the tension that was showing up instead of trying to blame other people for it, just constantly adjust to it. That's the best way to do it, is that because if you're trying to somehow or another think that your suffering is going to end because using your scenario, that the evil prosecutors are going to eventually get it, not going to happen. Not going to happen. It would be like a prosecutor thinking that at some point the defense attorneys are going to understand that we're the fighters of good and righteousness. So the idea is it's beginning to see that inherent in the idea that the problem is them and those and that's the problem. Because that is a distraction from us seeing this suffering that's actually happening. That's what we're looking for. We want to look for and feel that tension. Whatever that tension is or whatever's driving it, we want to feel that. And you want to find the practice to work with resolving that tension. And unfortunately, what that means is we don't get to blame anybody. There's no demons out there. It's all me, and it's all in here. And so that, you just begin to practice in that way. And then things begin to shift and adjust. Little bit by little bit. Yeah?
I was wondering if you could say more about the three characteristics in working with suffering. And I don't know what the three characteristics
okay.
are. Okay. Probably said it, but...
Sure. So the question was... About, if I can talk a little bit more about the three characteristics and what they are.
And how you work with them, with suffering.
So the three characteristics are called, they're called the three characteristics, and it, what it is all phenomena, everything that exists, exists with three basic characteristics. All phenomena exist in this inherently... impermanent nature. So even though we're in a building that feels like it's solid, the building is continuously deteriorating. Even though we think of ourselves as being alive and permanent, we are continuously running closer to death. So everything we have is based in this condition that it's inherently impermanent. Because things are always, seasons change, everything is always changing, we are always just shy of being still and steady. So there's this dissatisfaction always in life, this constant rub about life. And then the last aspect of all phenomena, existence, is that it's non, it doesn't have any inherent value in it. So it's not really personal, it doesn't have any inherent value. We give things value, we give this building value, but just as easy as we no longer use the building could just fall apart, nobody would even care about it. I mean, there are like buildings on Capitol Hill that sometimes I look at them, I'm like, oh my God, Capitol Hill and this building's run down? What? It's because there's no current value with the people that own it. So even though I can look at it and say, oh my God, there's a lot of value, but there could be, you know, all kinds of circumstances why somebody is just not paying attention to that building. So the three characteristics are this impermanence, the nature of dissatisfaction with this constant impermanence, and the idea that nothing has any inherent value. We say it's not personal, but what it means is there's no inherent value to anything, aside from the value we give it. So if you take those three things, at any time that you feel any rub or discomfort or something that we would consider suffering, you could shine a light on it and look for where is in this, am I trying to hold on to something that really it's leaving and I want it to stay? Am I just uneasy about the nature of things changing and I don't want them to change, I just want it to stay the same? Is there just kind of a ill will about just the way things are now? Like things were good and life was going along good and then all of a sudden I go out to my car and I can't start it up and it's like I gotta go to work and now I don't have enough money to fix this stupid thing. Why do I have a car? Blah, blah, blah. All of that dissatisfaction in the nature of things, because if you have a car, at some point it is going to stop working. And if you have a new car, it's around 100,000 miles. They're like disposable cars. So they're inherent in that car, is it not working? So we get caught in these, you can look at the, you could take one of the characteristics and just shine a light on it and begin to notice that angst you're having, is it connected to one of the characteristics that's inherent in this situation? And you try to look for it. Do you see? Does that make sense? Okay, good. Oh, yeah.
So I see this in myself and actually a lot of my friends too, and I'm just sort of curious around it. So I feel like I'm okay with my own suffering, like I can be with that, but I want my kids to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
They're just that other mirror of more opportunities to work with the suffering, but it's
So the question was around being okay with her own suffering, but then she has problems when she thinks about her kids suffering, right?
Yeah, but I want them to be happy.
Want them to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that points more towards the Four Noble Truths, because the reason why I think the Four Noble Truths really apply in those kinds of situations is because they are emotional, habitual pattern type things. And emotional, habitual pattern type things are driven by habitual behavior. So a lot of what we think we're doing, we think we're applying it new and afresh to this moment. But really, it's just a habit, and that habit plays over and over and over and over, and we get caught in it. So then when you try to say, your kids grow up, and you just try to say, okay, I'm just going to let them go, live their life. I'm not going to do that. We have the same habit pattern, especially for parents, because I can tell you horror stories about some of the things my kids say about, please, mama, just let it go. It's my life. Just let it go. I can't. I try not to. You know, I try to be very sneaky about it. Just checking in, see how things go. But they will be like, please, just let me live my own life. And I can feel the tension in me. And ultimately, it's sort of like beginning to see where that suffering is coming from. It's not coming from them or the way they're living their lives. It's coming from these habitual ways that I think about them as being my kids. When they were my kids, I had way more, they probably wouldn't want me to say it this way, but way more control. I don't have that, but I still live out of the same habitual energy. So the idea is to take the practice and actually sit with that discomfort and watch where it comes from. In Ajahn Sumedho's talk that I'm gonna, his interview that I'm gonna bring next week, he actually says that he would bring up jealousy just to watch it. That's all. There is no requirement to do anything about it. So whatever the difficulty is with the kids, it's just watching your difficulty and taking your attention off of them and putting it back on you and watching your difficulty. And that's it. It's what Joseph is pointing to. If you saw that this is a hot coal, this amber in your hand, you're going to let it go. But mostly we don't see it because we put all our attention out there. And we never really have to feel just how unnecessarily painful some of our choices are. And that's what it's pointing to. Okay? Okay, well, I have to stop. Thank you very much. And I do want to share a couple announcements, though.